Welcome to the Positive Education Podcast with Ash Manuel. As we know, the number one hot topic in the world is mental well-being. Ash has worked with close to 1,000 organisations impacting more than 250,000 people, including schools, sports teams and businesses across 45 countries. Today, Ash is regarded as a global thought leader in positive education. In this podcast, you'll hear stories, information and actionable ideas from positive education and well-being experts. The purpose of the podcast is so that you take away ideas that you can execute in your classroom, across your school, at your sports club and in your organisation, plus tips and tricks that you can apply in your own life.
Hi everyone and welcome to the Positive Education Podcast. I'm your host Ash Manuel and I'm really excited today to be talking with Sean Kasbergen. Sean is a passionate educator with a heart for student well-being. With 20 years experience and 9 years as a senior leader across multiple schools, Sean has been a head of faculty, head of house, a head of middle school, and is currently the director of student wellbeing at Scotch College Adelaide, where he's spent the last six years leading the college's strategic and innovative approach to wellbeing and mental health in education. He has spoken nationally and internationally on the topics of creativity, innovation, and wellbeing. On a personal level, Sean is a proud husband, and father of two young children, an avid cyclist racing with Nord Cycling Club, a huge NBA and AFL fan. Hi, Sean, and thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ash. How are you?
Very good, mate. Very good. Now, just before we get into some of the amazing work that Scotch has or does in the space of wellbeing, I just want to hear, the benefit of the listeners, just a bit about your background, how you got into education, and how you ended up being overseeing wellbeing at Scotch College here in Adelaide.
All right, a brief history of time. That should be easy enough to give. So, Ash, I think it's fair to say I always wanted to be in education. I knew from a very early age that I wanted to be a teacher. I'd probably pinpoint that going back to year four. And it was just a skill set and a disposition that I felt I had. And that just remained true throughout my schooling. But I guess the big question was the what. Like I had the why. I wanted to make a difference to young people's lives, really connect, really understand what it is that motivates people and can leverage them towards success. But I didn't necessarily know the how or the what to do that. And I don't think that picture really became clear until after year 12, I backpacked around Europe and met all kinds of amazing people and had all the brilliant conversations that you would anticipate happen in that context and the inspiration that comes with visiting galleries, museums, and just going really deep into that. So I ended up becoming not only a health and physical education teacher, but also a French teacher as well. And those two are, you know, not necessarily obviously complementary, but outstanding subject to teach in schools, like just fascinating. And so that's taken me everywhere. That's taken me across the world to not only study exchanges internationally, whether France or elsewhere, but also to live and work in international contexts as well. But I guess the more immediate sort of term, I've always lived in Adelaide, I suppose, and I've always seen Scotch as a school that had wellbeing in its DNA, so to speak. I don't think we had the language for that when I first thought it, but I knew that it produced really well-rounded graduates. I knew that it always had a focus on relationships first. And so as a professional, when you look at the schools that you want to work at, you start to go, okay, well, where is what I value going to have a match? Mm. And I always saw Scotch as that. And so I've had the opportunity to work there twice, actually. So it's actually my second innings. I first arrived there in 2006, and that was incredible. I was able to be a French teacher primarily and reinvigorate a program there. That led me to taking students overseas on trips and really doing what I felt was my core to open and broaden horizons for young people through that language lens. What also happened at that time was that I was able to start learning more about the pastoral approach in schools and becoming a head of house at Scotch. And whilst I did that, I also started to engage in my master's in education. And it was actually early years. A lot of things were coming through around positive education and Master of Applied Positive Psychology. And so I enrolled in just a straight Master of Education at Flinders, and they just implemented some amazing new topics and subjects around the promotion of positive mental health and behaviour, positive behaviour supports and educational psychology, leadership, strategic planning, and all of that really combined just beautifully into what I was hoping to achieve from that master's program. That's since gone on to be even bigger and better, and certainly a great avenue for anyone if they wanted to pursue that. But that led to me becoming a head of middle school at St. John's Grammar. And that was an unbelievable position, and I still feel privileged to have been in that position to really focus on the young people in year 7 to 9. And I think a lot of what's true to say is that a lot of the impact that was made was looking at things through a wellbeing lens again, and making key strategic initiatives based on that. And so when the Scotch position came up for a director of student wellbeing back in it was late 2015, I initially went through all the turmoil of, well, you don't go back somewhere that you've already been. Like, why would you do that? You always move forward. But I could see what Scotch were planning or conceptualizing was very innovative, completely contemporary, and really, again, that values match that I was seeking. So to focus on the wellbeing of an entire community, so yes, the students, ELC to year 12, but yes, the staff, yes, the parents, and beyond, old collegians, et cetera, all that, to be able to be the person that could advocate, be challenged, challenge conventional narratives around psychology and wellbeing, and really bring an education lens to it. That's what led me to be where I am now.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, was that the wellbeing position, was that a new position, or was that an existing one that the person before left?
Yeah, it evolved. So in 2012, they developed a position for a coordinator of positive education.
Yep.
And so that was a position that ran for 3 years prior, from 2013 to 2015.
Yeah.
And I think there were a lot of really great learnings that came out of that, and good challenges for the community about how we think about whether it was positive psychology, whether it was wellbeing, what kind of language and terminology we wanted to use. And so I was able to come in really on the shoulders of what was outstanding work being done in that space over those 3 years.
Yep, fantastic. I'm always interested to see how wellbeing programs are set up at school in terms of the structure of the staff. So do you do any teaching in the classroom at all, or is it purely the admin side of the wellbeing overseeing the whole program, which I know that's what you do, but is there teaching involved as well?
Yeah, there absolutely is, and delightfully so. So initially, there was a Year 7 program, which we wrote and created, and I delivered that.
Yep.
I also taught French a little bit as well, so I came straight back into teaching Year 12 French and those pieces. So it's ducked and weaved a little bit, but what I actually now get to do is champion our Year 9 program, and that's called 9 at Scotch, which is the college's response to this is a really interesting period of time for young people. And so I get to lead that piece. So it started off as a 0.4 teaching piece. I'd say it's probably now just somewhere around 0.2 in terms of a teaching piece, just to give me that agility and flexibility to, expand the conversation college-wide.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. Now, mate, I'd love to talk about the whole school approach to wellbeing, because as you said before, ELC right through to year 12 and beyond with staff, parents, and even the old scholars. So, I guess how and why did Scotch and yourself, or how did you go about creating that whole school approach? I guess the first is a two-part question. Why did you feel that it was really important to have a whole school approach? That's the first question. And then what are some of the steps that you took to actually make it happen?
Oh, brilliant. So you're right. The why is the really important piece here. And I think it's essential to evaluate that question with the broader college community. And where I sort of put it right at the start was to say, well, what are the wellbeing needs of a contemporary learner? And so inherent in that question is that wellbeing challenges that students face now and into the future are going to be vastly different to those of generations past. So once you ask that question, the conversation immediately moves to the knowledge, skills, supports, and overarching wellbeing literacy that people are going to need as they develop, grow, and lead both now and into the future. So I guess I look at a number of core reasons as to why we need wellbeing programs in schools. Probably got a list of four.
So fantastic. We'll
break them down one by one. So,
perfect.
Although I will say, like, once you ask that question about, well, what are the wellbeing needs of contemporary learner, everyone has a chance to answer that question in their own way. And I think that's important. That just adds to the dialogue. But since I've been asked, these are mine.
Yeah, absolutely. Go for it.
So I think, firstly, we know that there's this increasing incidence of wellbeing concerns at younger ages, and that can lead to behaviours that might inhibit a young person's or any individual's wellbeing for that matter. And so that negative affect that we start to experience, and as that creeps into things like anxiety and depression, we start to see things that might impact an educational experience. And they could be things like impaired social functioning, reduced academic functioning, you got stress, absenteeism. In the later years, you can see things like different forms of harm coming through. And that's all really concerning, because that means the education isn't the focus anymore. There's a barrier there. Mm. I'd also say we're all motivated by the many statistics that are coming through, and I certainly won't list them all, but the ones that, you know, really motivate me to develop authentic and innovative approaches to wellbeing in schools are that, you know, 50% of lifelong mental health conditions commence before the age of 14, and then it's 75% by the age of 24. That was the study done by Kessler. I think that puts education in the center of the conversation. I mean, they're education years, so schools should be looking at that and be concerned with that. We know that the World Health Organization forecasts that depression will be the number one health concern in both developed and developing nations by 2030. Mm. That's incredible. It basically implies that we've got almost a tsunami of mental health conditions coming our way, and so we need to be thinking about how to treat those effectively as soon as possible.
Mm. And actually, that stat was actually before COVID, wasn't it? Like that stat about the 2030, like World Health Organization prediction, that could even be brought forward.
It could be, and I haven't seen an update there, but I'd love to see one if you've got one.
No, I don't. But I'm just thinking, like, when you said that, because I've seen that research before as well, and I was thinking, gee, that's amazing. But just as soon as you said it, I'm thinking, well, that was pre-COVID. It could even be now. Who knows? But sorry, mate.
I completely agree, and I believe we're still learning about the impact that it had. I think initially when COVID hit, I was more concerned about the adults, given the impact and the broader sort of reach that it might have had for them. But now certainly becoming more and more concerned about students and some of the statistics that are rolling through there. I shouldn't mention too many because I haven't necessarily looked at the papers and studies myself yet. But some of them are alarming, and some of them suggest that the kids are okay. So we've just got to trawl through that a little bit deeper. The other one that I like is that, you know, I don't like it, but the other one that's informative is that one in four people will experience a mental health condition in their lifetime. And I think it's informative to say that, well, that probably means that three in four don't, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. But it means sort of that we've got to be educating towards the one in four, but also the three in four who might need to be able to help someone who is close to them in their lives, and understanding mental health and how to support those that are experiencing mental health concerns. So it is pervasive. It is for everybody. And it's not a spectator sport.
Absolutely.
we all have a role to play.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really good point about that. I don't think I've ever heard it put like that, when we focus on, and it's fair enough too, we focus on the one in four that do, but there is three in four that don't. And they, as you said, they can play a really key role in helping those others, whether that's modelling or showing them ways, giving them ideas, because I've gone through my struggles before as well. It's hard to think and know what to do, but if you've got people who can assist, then it's gonna help those people who really need it.
Absolutely. It's the communities that we choose to be a part of, or and how we can optimize those communities and make them as efficient and effective as possible in a range of concerns, but especially around the well-being and mental health conversation.
Absolutely.
I also am fascinated by this idea that as a society, we've progressed from this industrial age model into this social informational age, which I don't know that we all fully understand completely, but we do know that the skills required by students and graduates now are rapidly changing. So there's higher value being placed on things like interpersonal skills, creativity, critical thinking, communication, how to collaborate. And so my sentiment is that such skills are employed with greater facility when wellbeing is present. So if I'm feeling well, I'm you could use whatever term you want to describe that, things are easier. And I'm able to see the opportunities that might come in a really exciting, ever-changing, you know, 21st century or contemporary environment. Mm. We know that active participants in the global conversation, you know, they're going to be much better to seize those opportunities in tougher global circumstances and have better relationships in those circumstances if well-being is present. So it sort of underlies this idea that even if you went to any key world organization now, they're not just going to look at someone's academic results anymore. If you wanted to get a job at Google, yeah, they might look at the grades that you got, but they're going to look to much more. They're going to look to your ability to be adaptable and open-minded. They're going to want to see a love of learning and demonstration of that in the past. Yeah. They want to, yes, know that you've got some cognitive processing abilities, but they want to see that you can be humble. Mm. How do you demonstrate that through an academic transcript and own your successes, but also own your mistakes as well and deep expertise, that kind of thing. It was fascinating. I looked at some sort of scholarships that were offered around the world in different universities, and New York University in Abu Dhabi, if you wanted to be a successful, I mean, imagine going there to do your university study. It'd be a fantastic collection of all kinds of people from across the globe. But in order to win that scholarship, you know, you need to demonstrate that you've got a passion and commitment to change the world, that you've been involved in a range of extracurricular activities, that you're adventurous, you're entrepreneurial, you're an independent thinker, you understand and can and demonstrate resilience. Mm. It's incredible that these employers now, or even just people who are looking for scholarship, it's a different skill set. It really has moved on. And I'd posit that if well-being is not present, it's much harder to achieve those more contemporary skills that we're looking towards.
Oh, I couldn't agree with that more. I think, and that goes for sport as well. Like if you are a professional athlete in a team sport and you might have that competition where there might be two people going for one spot and you've both got similar skills and there's one a bit of got a reputation being a bit of a rascal, and then you've got the one who's shown to be a really good person, they've got that, I don't know, empathy for each other, they've got, or for other people, they've got that attitude where they appreciate things, appreciate others, they're going to get the nod every time. And it's the same, well, that's an example with sport, but as you say, it's the same with like going for jobs now as well. That's, they're probably, employees would rather employ good people who are coachable and teachable, but have those, like those skills to be a good person, like, and to show the, all those things that you mentioned about the creativity and I guess the gratitude side of things as well, the appreciation and willing to learn. And that's where definitely the world's going, just to highlight what you just said there, mate.
Yeah, right on. And I think it's even that in itself is anxiety inducing, just thinking about that concept that if I'm someone who didn't get the opportunity to learn about these concepts or show how I can be open-minded or resilient or perhaps I've got that reputation, I almost feel sorry now that that might be a situation that someone's put into. What I'd sort of flip that on though is that if there is someone who you know is good and it might be a line ball decision, I think it's actually a test of a culture. Like let's take that sporting club for example, that's thinking about drafting an individual with a bit of a checkered past. I mean, you can also back your culture there, I think, and just go, well, actually our community is so strong that we're going to be able to nurture this person so that they are valued and that performance that we know that they can give, might shine through more strongly than some of the past behaviours that we've seen, and we might be able to even avoid those. So we see that with some of the stronger AFL cultures in particular, that are able to take some people who might be questionable at the time and maybe work with them. So, you know, I think that's part of a wellbeing culture. Absolutely. As well in a sporting club or even a school. Scotch would certainly have students who come from other environments where perhaps they haven't been as successful, and I'd always put my hand on my heart and say we're able to achieve and value add with those students in such an unbelievable way. So yeah, it's important not to put a line through those people who can't show it. There's always ability to grow and enhance that potential.
Absolutely. Look, put my hand up for that one, mate. You came up with a good response there. It's 100% true what you say though, isn't it? Like it's, if you've got that culture at the school or sporting club, wherever it is, people get drawn to it as well. And same with staff. Like, in my teaching, it's pretty lucky, but you hear some stories from schools where the culture in the staff room could be quite negative, and a lot of gossip and a lot of complaining, a lot of whinging. But if a person goes into a school where the staff are positive and upbeat, it takes that person or takes them on that journey with everyone else, and it can change the way they think. But if you come into a negative staff, you can get drawn down as well. But so that, I think that culture is so important. It can be quite underestimated.
The conversations that take place in the staff room influence the conversations that take place in the, or the practices that take place in the classroom. Yeah. So you're quite right.
But,
and lots can be done around that. I've got one more for you.
Yeah, go on. Absolutely.
I think the third or maybe it's the fourth now, big reason is that there's just a growing body of evidence for positive mental health programs in schools. Mm. So we know that the right programs deployed at the developmentally appropriate stage can have significant impacts on the prevention of negative mental health experiences and the promotion of core lifelong positive mental health experiences and skills. So, you know, I believe that an education in wellbeing includes, but could sort of expand beyond this as well, the opportunity to learn about things like perfectionism, media literacy, social media literacy, and the rise of artificial intelligence, self-compassion, how to reduce worry, how to take control of your emotions, how to regulate those, how to boost your self-efficacy, express gratitude, things like leveraging strengths, setting goals, navigating challenge and change, you know, developing that moral compass and that sense of what's right and wrong, and how to make those decisions, not when you're sitting in a classroom, but when it's live. Mm. Asking things like what is my purpose and how does that link back to my identity and how often will it change and is it okay if it changes, and just constantly zooming in and out of that. Developing this sense of personal agency, I think, is so critical, and a great wellbeing program can do all of those things. And I think they're the big reasons I think that schools have to focus on wellbeing.
No, that's brilliant. Particularly, the last one that you mentioned about having that age-appropriate program, I think it's really, really important. Now, that is a great segue into how. So it's great to know that why or some reasons for doing it. And I'm a big one for the action. So, okay, that's great. We've got the reasons why, but how do we make it happen? So I know that one of the things that you played a big role in, Sean, about making it happen at the school was creating... would you call it a framework? The Scotch, the Scotch Fit framework. So, how did that come about? And does that play a key role in how the wellbeing program across the whole ELC to year 12 and beyond play that key role in how it's implemented?
Yeah, so clarity creates commitment is probably the thing I would say there. So it was important to define what the wellbeing language and framework was going to be for us, as it would be for any school. And it's fair to say that psychologists, wellbeing experts, happiness researchers, they've all got different meanings for what this could mean. So for our purposes at Scotch, I took that a definition actually first. So it was about, when we talk about wellbeing, what are we actually talking about? And so I took a definition from a paper written by someone called Rachel Dodge or Dodge, and it's actually called The Challenge of Defining Wellbeing. But the phrase that came out of that for me, and you can almost picture a seesaw as well with this one, but it's essentially, the quote is that, in essence, stable wellbeing is when individuals have the psychological, social, and physical resources they need to meet a particular psychological, social, and or physical challenge. And so when individuals have more challenges than resources, you've got this seesaw that can dip. And so I'll just paint that picture, actually. So if you picture a seesaw with a ball in the middle and then two sort of spectrums, on one end you've got resources, on another end you've got challenges. And if you've got too many resources, let's actually go challenges first. If you've got too many challenges, your wellbeing is going to dip. And so you need to find the resources to bring you back to that state of equilibrium. And so then the seesaw's back sort of on that stable level playing field.
Yep.
What I love about this definition is that it implies that wellbeing is never static. There's always an ebb and flow. There's always a dance between resources you have and the challenges you face. You don't achieve wellbeing throughout your life. It's going to be constantly growing physically, socially, psychologically. You're always going to be challenged. You're always going to have resources that you're trying to use. What I also love about this definition is that If you have too many resources and not enough challenges, your well-being also dips. And I think this is an interesting question to explore, particularly over the last 2 years. There's people with a lot of resources, but haven't been able to deploy them into a challenge that's going to meet their needs. And so people have started to languish a little bit or become stagnant or disengaged with different parts because there aren't enough challenges. And it works also, you know, it could be the kid who can do year 11 maths and they're sitting in a year 8 or 9 maths class. They need more challenges. They've got the resources. They want to do more. Mm. It could be the student who wants to really engage in service learning, but they just can't find how. They know they want to help. They know that that's their gift, but they don't have the avenue to do it. So they've got all these resources, but not enough challenges. Mm. So this beautiful definition that we found had built into it that stable well-being is when individuals have psychological, social, and physical resources. And so as a school, I thought, well, we'll throw in academic as well, and we'll call it this Scotch Fit piece. So Scotch Fit means being physically, socially, psychologically, and academically fit. And it works really well as a quadrant. And the fit piece actually came through from my health and physical education training back at Flinders University as well.
Yeah.
And I remember there was this concept that as an athlete, you're fit for X. And so we'd sit around and ask questions like, well, who's got a greater level of fitness? Is it the marathon runner or the weightlifter? And ultimately, they're both as fit as each other because the marathon runner can't do what the weightlifter does. The weightlifter can't do that either. And it's much like we understand this concept of physical fitness. Like if I wanted to go and run the city to bay or do the tour down under cycling ride, like I wouldn't jump on a bike the day before and think it's going to be okay. Like fitness is something that you build towards. And it's kind of a never-ending pursuit as well, a bit like the seesaw. So this idea that we're always pursuing physical fitness makes sense in Australian culture, I think. But we can apply that to pursuing psychological fitness. There are tools, strategies, actions we can take to be better or more fit psychologically, likewise socially, and likewise academically. And so that's where this idea of the Scotch Fit piece was really all came together, and it's worked really well for our community, I have to say. Like students now develop goals based on those quadrants. So from a very early age, year three upwards, they're starting to go, okay, what are my physical goals? What are my social goals? What are my psychological goals? What are my academic goals? Mm. And they get deeper and more contextual as you go through the school. So that's kind of the Scotch Fit piece and how it came about. I definitely acknowledge that there could be other pieces that come into that. So, and we wrestled with this. I didn't come up with this myself. It was the Student Wellbeing Action Group that came up with it back in the day, and that was inclusive of parents, staff, and students. And we all wrestled with it and thought, well, do we include other notions? And we decided they were the four that we wanted to go with. But it's led to other language. So we now talk every now and then about things like being future fit or spiritually fit, or the big one for the year we've just had and the year about to come is being organizationally fit. Like what does a fit organization look like? So it's been a really good framework from which to hang our program. It's also meant that staff can just go, okay, I'd like to do something in wellbeing, and it doesn't have to be purely psychological anymore. Like it can be an initiative that does focus on like whether it's physical, it could be sleep, diet, exercise, all the benefits that come with exercise and to mental health. It could be nutrition, that sort of thing. Socially, we could be looking at our service learning program, our character strengths, active constructive responding, social media skills, risk-taking, relationship, all of that kind of stuff. Each category, like staff are now able to go, okay, like I see what kind of initiative I could kind of run here and what where it might fit within the college program.
Absolutely. That's so just to clarify, does FIT, is FIT an acronym for anything, or is it like as in FIT, as in explained it as psychological, academic, physical? Yeah, that's what it means, doesn't it? It's not actually
I'm encouraged to think of one now. I wouldn't mind thinking about what an acronym could be. But
I wasn't sure if it fit in under an acronym. It was just like fitness and mental and physical fitness. But that's great. I think you went into it a little bit then, but I think it's really important for a school to name their programs or their frameworks like Scotch Fit or whatever it might be. So what have you found the benefit of having that name is that students are able to relate to it more. They know when you're talking about it, they can, it switches on straight away what it means. Is that what's been the benefit of calling it a name?
Yeah, well, firstly, I'd say that it didn't come out by accident, so there's ownership over it. Like, yep. Students had a say in it, staff had a say in it, parents had a say in it. So there's that sense of ownership. But yep. What it also means is that from the chair of the college council, when he speaks to parents at his opening address for the year, right down to, any year level, so let's say early primary years, like, it's accessible and people can engage with it. So I feel like it's been really usable to say, okay, and now we're going to focus on our physical fitness. Now we're going to focus on our academic fitness.
Yep.
And so it's given a framework and language around these are the conversations that we have anyway, and let's plant them into that. But actually, we probably need to encourage ourselves to talk a little bit more about some different skill sets that might fit under that, like whether it's metacognition or mindfulness, bringing that into the conversation, and where does that fit? Where does resilience fit? So how can we do more within those pieces? And if I'm a year three teacher looking to want to run a wellbeing week, I can start to go, okay, well, I'm going to make sure that I've got elements that there's physical fitness in there, there's some psychological fitness, there's some social fitness, and there's some academic fitness in there. So it becomes more holistic in its treatment, rather than, we're going to run a wellbeing initiative and it's going to be, we're going to get a guest speaker in on mindfulness. But we need to be more expansive in the way that we look at what wellbeing activities and actions can be taken in schools, and that's permitted us to really do that with a broad take and given an equal footing to the physical, social, psychological and academic. No one is more important than the other, so to speak.
Absolutely. So that's a fantastic framework. So what does it look like? So, for example, you mentioned, and I totally 100% agree, you've got to have the age-appropriate initiatives and programs placed in or put in place. So right from ELC to year 12 with the students, first of all, what does it look like? Do you have some programs that junior primary do, then the middle school do a different one? I kind of know a bit of the answer. So do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Absolutely. And I'm not sure if you want me to mention specific programs, though. It was really important in the early phases to say, okay, we're going to need some key focus points to help augment the language. So part of that strategy was initially, yes, we need a vision, a definition, a framework. But the next part was, we actually need to make sure that we've got the right spine of programs running through the school. Because, yes, it's an ecology of wellbeing. It means everybody in the school should have some underpinning and an understanding of what they can do to support their own and others' wellbeing. But we also need those standalone moments. And that's where the growing with gratitude piece was ideal. And I remember the early days when we were conceptualizing, I was like, well, this is perfect in its not only its design, because I think our job is to take all these wonderful concepts and research that's coming through and putting it into a pedagogically relevant way. Like, we know so much and we're all alarmed by statistics, but we've got to take the psychology and then put it into pedagogy. And so that's where the spine of programs came through. So we do have a mix of programs that we've selected, but also programs that we've created. And so in the ELC, we actually use all of our assessment through what we're calling wellbeing scales, and that's all influenced by the Reggio Emilio approach. Once you hit reception, we do run the growing with gratitude piece, and we run that through to year three. That's been outstanding. So I can speak very highly of the prompt that that's given us as a community. And those five habits of happiness, for example, are just completely aligned with what we're trying to achieve. So that was neat. In years four to six, we've got a different program. We use a second step program in conjunction with some other pieces that we've developed, and I can talk about those as we go through. But we're not afraid to completely suspend the curriculum for a week to run an activity that's centered around wellbeing or a wellbeing concept. And I might expand on those a bit later. Once you're year seven, we do have dedicated time. There's three lessons a week for wellbeing,
and that starts at year seven.
It doesn't go through every year, but most years it does. Year seven's kind of that soft landing point. Our year sevens do graduate to high school, and so we've got a different setup for them. But they'll get three wellbeing lessons a week with their home group teacher or their core classroom teacher, that puts them through. What happens after that is really quite beautiful, and something that we've implemented only recently is that we now have heads of house who have significant release time to make sure that every student in the senior school is known, nurtured, valued and challenged. And part of that is that they do teach a wellbeing lesson to their team in years 8, 9 and 10. And we've crafted our own experiences entirely around that.
Yep.
That's something we've brought in last year and will continue to grow. But it's just that idea that there's one person who's going to deeply understand and know and support that learner as they go through from 7 all the way through to 12. So it's that there's strengths in a vertical model and year-level coordinators, but we just found that by having that one person who can look after the well-being of that person as they, when they come into year 7, you know, they're just, you know, energetic, delightful person, but almost by the time they've hit year 10, they're a young adult. Mm. And to have that, as I'll say it again, but to have that one person overseeing that development, all the conversations with the family, whether it's going well or whether there needs to be some different interventions, like that's amazing. So we've designed some curriculum pieces there, but we have those touch points. Like we have Healthy Minds, which is a program with Dr. Tom Neamy from Adelaide as well. That's an outstanding touch point in year 8 that we do. We've that 9 at Scotch program, which I lead, which is predicated on the idea of wellbeing. And there are different pieces in year 10, 11 and 12 through our pastoral curriculum as well. So they're the standalone specific moments, but I'll always go back to the idea that every teacher in the school is a wellbeing teacher. Mm. and can model pro wellbeing and pro Scotch fit behaviours at any time.
Mm. And I guess that comes back to training the teachers about how they can do that as well, like about those moments within without, obviously you've got your standalone lessons, but something could come up in a history lesson or whatever it is, PE, where the Scotch fit can be talked about. So do you do staff training sessions and then model those to the teachers how they can do that?
Well, yeah, we absolutely do. And there's multiple ways I can look at responding to that, but most start of the year, I'll go over the program again and then talk about how people can access it. I think it's really important that staff have some agency around it, so they can sort of pick and choose about how they might respond in different situations. But for example, we try and train as many staff as we can in things like the Healthy Minds training. I think that gives a really great lens through. We also have all of our middle leaders have gone through youth mental health first aid training as well.
Yep,
so we try and have those key touch point professional learning experiences wherever possible. And then we'll just, whenever something comes up, whether there's a PD through BU, might be on anxiety or a new program coming out, like we'll send different staff. We try and diversify who gets exposed to those, and then a bit of a responsibility to come back and report on that as well. Mm. So, we really try and diversify who gets the access to those different pieces. Mm. One group though I've completely neglected to bring up here is the students, and I haven't done that purposefully. They're incredible. We've got student leaders sort of speckled right throughout the curriculum, but to have students prompt us in what we should be talking about is the critical piece here. So we've got formally student action team leaders for wellbeing in year 9 and 12, and their whole role is to make sure that student wellbeing is actionable and doable, so that it's not just this piece that is talked about in a classroom. It's actually something that might come alive at lunchtime, and it might come alive in a different way, whether it's they'll have outreach that we don't necessarily have and perspectives that we don't necessarily have. So when a student, we know that when a student, not limiting our own roles as teachers, but when a student gets up an assembly or reaches out to a particular student, like that has a different capital and a different power to it than a teacher doing it. And so we definitely empower students to be involved in the wellbeing conversation and put in initiatives and actions throughout the year, every year.
What's some of those examples of those groups that they've done? Like I think you have the action teams in year 9, like year levels. How's it work?
Yeah, so let's say I'm the year 12 person. I'll have a team underneath me that supports me as well, and anyone can volunteer to be a part of that team.
Yep.
And they'll meet and decide what they're going to do. But the things that have been really successful are things like 21-day challenges. So we'll have a 21-day challenge around drinking more water or getting more sleep,
yep.
or limiting distraction and procrastination, getting off the screens, those kinds of things. So they'll say, these are things that we think we need help with. You know, just a persistence challenge. They'll talk about things like imposter syndrome. So they'll they'll go to assembly and get up and use the platform to talk about things like that. They'll talk about, what else could they, what else has happened over the years? There'll be pieces around, I'm trying to think of some good ones. Apologies.
Is that year level or is that across the whole school? So those 21 day challenges, for example, is that, that's year 12? Is that just for the year 12s or for everyone?
It could be and has been, but usually it's whole school and staff as well. So I distinctly remember drinking exclusively water for 21 days and being excited that the coffee I was going to have on day 22 was going to be delicious and it was just okay. But they will run a Mindful May, for example, different pieces like that as they go through. And generally they'll say, well, I don't want this just to be something that I do with my year 12s or just with 7 to 12. Let's get down to the junior school as well.
Yep.
And maybe they run a health hustle or maybe they speak at an assembly. There'll be all kinds of activities that they'll put in place. Are you okay day? Like all those key significant days they generally celebrate in some way or another. But sometimes it's pretty raw as well. Like they'll actively just speak about anxiety and the impact that can have, or depression and the impact that can have, and run some really elegant pieces of assembly around that as well.
And I guess you need obviously the teachers, so the students come up with these initiatives and ideas, but I guess it's important to have the staff involved as well to oversee it, to manage it. Do you have someone aligned to each of those? I think you mentioned this before, that you've got the head of house. Is that their role with these wellbeing groups? Or is it more of a wellbeing action team? I think you said this might be more like it. So you've got the few staff, parents, the kids, or is that different, the action team?
It's been quite amazing because it might start with me trying to lead it, but there'll be that interest that comes from a different staff member or perhaps a natural disposition with another staff member. So it's an entirely inclusive opportunity in that way, and generally it's like, oh well, I know that person is going to be able to help me with this, so I'm going to talk to them and get them to help me out at lunchtime or help me put it in place, etc. So it's actually been quite inclusive and a great conversation to happen.
I think, and that's one of the things, isn't it, like you've got to, and teachers as well, like I know that it's a very busy profession, but if you can give some extra time at those lunch times to help out, like it's a good feeling to be a part of as well, like
Absolutely. I mean, we've done like another initiative that I had was like a look up lunch where basically it was just like, let's just get everyone outside playing volleyball on the lawns, or we'd put on a little barbecue or some cupcakes, other activities, whether it's like, you know, bulls or petanque, like just everyone out there. And they've even done one where it was like, well, let's deliberately just try and interact with the year sevens when they're new. So year 12s just invite all the year sevens to come in and have that conversation and play some games with them. So there's all kinds of different things, but it's always been inclusive of staff too. And they're definitely a key group of people who need to look after their wellbeing too.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, mate, we're out of time here, but I've just got one more question to ask. So with your wellbeing program, is there some standout stories that how students have used what they've learned in their wellbeing program to help them overcome like significant challenges? Is there anything that stands out in that space as what you've noticed yet?
Yeah, I think there is, and it's probably really hard to pinpoint one initiative or one child. It might even be unfair to do that, but I can think to some initiatives that have definitely had amazing outcomes, and I sort of think a lot of the time that they come from, it might have been an educational experience that they had through a program, but I think it comes from a broader encouragement and nudge that things like agency, things like voice, and things like focusing on wellbeing are important to us at the school. And I'll give you a couple of examples where I think it's been really beneficial. And I go straight to year five. I mentioned earlier that we paused the curriculum for a week. And the question that we asked them throughout that week, which was all sort of well prompted and structured to do it, but we basically just said, how can we be a more inclusive school? And so this just led to kids working in groups saying, well, how can we best promote connection, care, belonging within our community? And what was sort of outstanding that came out of that is that one group, all groups were amazing, but one group developed an app that promoted awareness and understanding for neurodiverse learners, which, you know, another group came up with a pitch for getting a sensory resource pack for every class, and they had to pitch it to the principal and get funding for it.
Yeah.
And so that whenever I've seen that student voice and agency come through, like I just think about all the strengths that would have been necessary for that, whether it's perspective, the intelligence, the industriousness, or even just the love to go, well, I want to look after my peers. Mm. And here's how I can best do that. And so we saw that in year fives, and it was just incredible to go and witness those presentations. That's and a similar thing happened with our year sixes as well. So they did a task called Healthy Me. And so they could pick any concept that might enhance their mental health or their well-being. So a lot immediately went to things like diet, sleep, exercise, connection, you know, approaches to relationships, that kind of thing. And what it meant was that the students were able to go, okay, well, this is something I'm interested in, struggling with, passionate about. I've now got this platform to reach out to experts, community members, families, and it was amazing. And so they all came up with these incredible opportunities. But to hammer the point home even further, we said, well, if you like, you could present this to the senior leadership team at the school, and we'll get members of the school's wellbeing advisory committee, and you can pitch your program and your ideas and thoughts to them.
Mm.
And so what we see come through there is there's this curiosity to investigate something that they're interested in, the courage to then present it to a panel of, you know, experts. And I just think that's incredible. And the experience is amazing because I was able to go down and watch them, and like I was met at the office with a pack, like with a drink and a muffin and a cookie in there, like, so I could really enjoy myself throughout these presentations and so the creativity that went into that.
Yeah.
I just think that's incredible. That's early year stuff that you're able to do. And
yeah.
that no doubt leads to greater cohesion as a year level, greater understanding of any possible prompt that we want to enhance our own well-being. Mm. And those conversations I know then flow into the home and well beyond the classroom. So those ripples are well and truly prevalent. And it just continues. Like, so year eights do this amazing task, which is predicated on our whole thing called a Live Well program. So the Live Well program is actually six pillars that we believe underpin well-being at Scotch, which means we actually start with sustainability and sustainable agriculture, which leads into food technology and nutrition. It then leads into physical well-being, onto psychological well-being, onto our global responsibility to look at these things. It goes beyond ourselves, but then also that we need to engage in service learning and maybe make a difference in some of those other communities beyond ours. Mm. And so year eights were prompted with this idea to, and it goes across all the subjects, to go, okay, you're about to run the cross country. What would you eat? What would you grow? And then what would you eat in order to fuel your physical performance? And then what benefit does that have to your psychological performance as well? Mm. And then how could you bring this initiative, this meal that you've made, like what does it look like? Can we grow these foods in other parts of the world? And if we were to make this a service-related activity, what would we do? And it's quite amazing because they start to look at the one, how do you grow food? And we know that students who grow their own food are much more likely to then select a healthy food option when given the choice.
Mm.
There's some research coming out of the UK around that. But so you've gone from the paddock to the plate, prepared your own food. You've not only grown it, you've prepared it. You've then consumed it, knowing that it's going to boost or potentially should boost your physical performance. But we know that healthy eating boosts our psychological performance. But we've got this global responsibility to make the world a better place. So we've done all the stuff for ourselves, but then it extends past us. And especially when we're looking at conversations around food shortage across the world, et cetera, like amazing start.
Mm.
And then engaging in service learning, they actually came up with a way to make growth plots that could be packaged up out of wood packaged up out of wood and sent to different parts of the world so that people could cultivate seeds in disadvantaged communities and perhaps start a micro business, et cetera, around that. I mean, just amazing stuff. But in terms of what I've seen students do at the end of this, so that Live Well program goes from 5 to 9. At the end of year 9, like, I see students creating socially responsible enterprises. They go through a transformative 2-week camp program and they come home and they're totally self-aware. They're aware of their interactions with others and the environment. And they'll do things like get home from this experience and just sit and spend time with their parents and ask them questions and get to know their parents in a way that they've never done before. Parents always sort of jaws are on the floor going like, what have you done to my child? They're amazing suddenly. They want to spend time with their siblings and just play and hang out, where previously it might have just been bickering and not really wanting to play with them. And they're helping out around the house, all that kind of that Operation Home Search stuff. Like, so I really feel that, like, by investing early, like, you start to see the outcomes later. And the last sort of thing we do in year 9 is this power of purpose task, where you can choose your own adventure about how you want to undertake it. But I see people, one of the tasks, you can write a gratitude letter. And you know, some prompts on how to do that. But one student said, oh, well, I'm not just going to write one. Like, I've got so many people who are important to me. In fact, a lot of students say that. But one student took it to 50 in 1 year. And it's like, go for it. So I've had students write 50 gratitude letters. I've had another student learn how to write their letter in a foreign language so that their grandparents could read it. In their own tongue. And I just think that's incredible. And you know, starting those What Went Well journals to hijack their negative biases and overcome our brain's natural disposition there. Like, so many good pieces. But overarchingly, I'll always say it's about a community. And like any community, we definitely have challenges, but I always see us come together. I always see that if someone is experiencing difficulty, not only are we really good at the getting around that person initially and doing the early identification piece and trying to find the support there, but I think our students also understand how to seek help and who we can talk to within our organization. So that might even be the biggest piece. Like, they might develop this great toolkit of all the things that they can do to boost either proactively or in some cases responsibly their well-being. But it's never in isolation. It's always a part of a broader ecosystem. And I think that's probably where we see the biggest pieces.
Absolutely. And I think it's an amazing skill to have. Like, if you are going through a rough time, like, having that self-awareness, okay, I'm not in a best place, and then taking the ownership of it to do something about it. And the earlier we can, as humans, we can learn that, the better off we're going to be. Because I think, I'm no expert on it, but what I understand is, some ways that depression can form is like these little things happen and then they stack on top of each other and then it gets out of control, it can spiral out of control, and we don't know what to do to handle situations. But when things do come up, if we can have that self-awareness to say to ourselves, look, I'm not in the best place at the moment, I understand it's up to me to take responsibility and do something about it, and then that ownership of it to ask for help or whatever it might be to, I guess, help move forward from that challenge. So seeing those results, mate, from a whole school community approach is, obviously it's definitely doing a really good job of what it's intended to do. So it's amazing. And I guess it doesn't happen overnight as well. So you've mentioned a lot there. So it just wasn't like a flick of a switch and thinking all these programs are going to come up overnight. Like, it does take time. And I think for schools all schools are on their journeys in a different way, in a different path. So I know that Sean mentioned a lot of things there, but that's over 5 or 6 years, isn't it, that you just mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of it, you know, I might conceptualize what would be a really great activity or initiative to do in a certain year level, but that doesn't mean it's just going to immediately translate and everyone else understands and wants to do it. And I think what's been really great is to actually, you know, take that deep breath and say, well, let's let people develop. Sounds pejorative. Give people the freedom to just work with the framework and develop their own initiatives. And I think that's been an absolute game changer in terms of, well, it's not just this program and you have to teach this in this way at that time. Like, what else could we do? Like, let's broaden the conversation here. And that's led to the true innovation and the really exciting pieces. But I think that actually does come from a culture that we've tried to establish. I I don't think I'd mentioned, but our college strategic plan is to embed wellbeing deeper into the heart of everything that we do. And so that means from, yes, the curriculum, yes, the co-curricula, but also things like the people and the HR element, people and culture element, our finance teams, they have to figure out about how they're going to do wellbeing. So it should touch every single person within the organization, and every single person should be thinking, well, how can I do this? And what can I apply to enhance my wellbeing so that I can in turn enhance the wellbeing of the students and communities I'm serving? So, yeah, I think that's,
Yeah, absolutely. So one more question before we finish is, so what would, if you were giving some advice to a school about to start their wellbeing journey, or they've been going for a while but they wouldn't mind some new ideas, what would be the first thing to do, do you think?
If you were just starting?
If
you were just starting, I would ask a very similar question. So something around, what are the wellbeing needs of young people in this contemporary world that we're in? Because we know that that will bring up, it not only engages people in the question, it starts to have some buy-in. So, and generally people will bring up things like, oh, it's about resilience and belonging and connection and empathy and self-efficacy. But rather than pejorative or just, you know, leading from the front, you actually start to lead from the side, or start to own this narrative collectively. And from there, you can start to go, okay, well, what's our vision? Like, what are we trying to achieve here? What's our definition for wellbeing going to actually be? What's our framework? What programs do we have? How can we leverage those? Do we need new things coming in? Or do we need to start from scratch? And then it's probably about going, okay, well, this is what we want. Let's see what's going on out there, and let's connect with different schools who we know might be doing it well, or use the resources that are around me. So they're probably the points that I start at, and not losing sight that it is a whole school approach. So it does need to be staff, students, parents, and in turn beyond. It might be easy to start with the students, but yeah, fair enough. I know some schools think you've got to start with the staff, and I don't disagree with that, but I think you can't just have the students waiting to do something while you work on the staff. So you probably do need to start things, might be complementary, but in parallel in some senses as well. But just get started, I suppose. Like, don't wait too long. Like, don't look too long before you leap into some things, and try some things, and go with the courage that not everything will be 100% effective or amazing. And some things may not be optimal, they may even fail, but let's move forward fast from those failures and find a way to get to the heart of what we actually want to do.
Absolutely. I think experimenting is a really big thing, because even what works for a school context like Scotch may not work for another school, and it's about working out and trying those things in your own school context to see what works. But as you say, I think to start, that's always be my philosophy about anything. Just have a go, then you work it out as you go. Obviously it's good to have some ideas of where to start, and I think that definition of wellbeing is a really good one, because it's so broad, like it can mean so many different things, wellbeing.
Correct.
And that one that you gave, I'll make a little note of that in the show notes to so people can look at that as well. I'll put a reference in there to that, but
it's a great paper.
Sounds really good, so definitely be checking that one out. But mate, really appreciate your time and sharing your insights to the Scotch Fit approach, or at Scotch College, here in Adelaide. It's been lucky enough to know Sean and be working with Scotch for about since 2016 probably, or 17. It's a fantastic school. They got a great approach across the whole school, and it's great to see it evolve over the last, coming up to probably 5 or 6 years now, and looks like it's going to go from strength to strength, and the foundation's been set, and the students are certainly lucky to be involved in such a fantastic wellbeing program, mate. So well done.
Oh, beautiful, Ash. Thank you so much for that kind endorsement. It's an absolute pleasure to talk about wellbeing in more depth, and the more we have these conversations, the better we get. So thank you.
And if people want to get in touch with you, where's the best place? Is it social media, LinkedIn, or where's the best place?
That's a good question. Where is the best place? I'd probably say it's probably through the school. Yep. So yeah, through email, which you can pop in the notes, I suppose.
Excellent, mate. Yeah. Sounds great. Well, thanks, Sean. I really appreciate your time, and enjoy the rest of your holidays. As of this recording, we're in the January. Oh no, no, we're not. Just 30th of December as we're recording. So I hope you enjoy the rest of the holidays, mate, and all the best for 2022.
Good, as you too. Happy New Year.
Thanks, mate. You too. See you, mate.
Ciao.